Pseudopod, episode 106, September 5th, 2008. This week's story, Jihad Over Innsmouth, by Edward Morris. Hi, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm Alistair, your host, and this week's story comes to us from Edward Morris. Edward's work has appeared elsewhere in Interzone, Murky Depths, and many others, and this story first saw print at Owl Soup. Your narrator this week is Ben Phillips, master of both funk and evil. So, make sure your tray tables are in the upright position, and prepare to board, because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
Jihad Over Innsmouth, by Edward Morris. A cold, black, liquescent fear laps at the edges of my heart as I approach the first gate in the long, caliph's maze of airport security. Some darker force is trying to sway me unobtrusively away to make me renege my retainer's oath, cut my losses, and run headlong to South America with the dwindling remains of my bank account. Should I die on my quest, a first-class seat in paradise awaits me. In my time, I have lived through every hell Shaitan could possibly devise right here on Earth, moving behind newspaper headlines which even Al Jazeera fears to run. Inquiring minds want to know, but some truths are better left to the darkness at the center of the universe, to be drowned out by the skirlings of the blind piper and his retinue of idiot flute players. But the oath I took goes deeper than the contract I signed with the old black man in Oakland last week. It is one our folk call fatwa, and it is not to be broken. Come flood or djinn or plague of insects, I will board this plane. I carry no arms upon my person. I'm simply afraid of Americans. This is a very hot land for me now. Every time I have to fly, I expect Justice Department agents in sober black suits and Agent Smith shades to surround me, barking on their surveillance headsets that I am under arrest for any one of 1,000 occupationally hazardous reasons which I forswore tabulating long ago. No minions of the law shew themselves in the crowd. My fear settles back inside me and changes shape. For myself, I merely offer a silent prayer to Allah that my limited human perceptions somehow interpreted the recent stars incorrectly. If not, as the American GIs I consult with put it, I'll be in a world of shit. They know they can batten down all the iron hooks of their Patriot Act upon me for any number of moving violations. If he were here, Dad would tell me I'm just being paranoid. But Dad's in Gaza on a contract of his own. In any case, your William Burroughs writes that perfect paranoia is perfect awareness. In my line of work, selective application of that idea holds the potential to save one's life. Under that lens, I realize that if they, definition subject to change without notice, felt like taking me out of the game, they could have done it by now. I can only assume I'm still in their good graces and travel at will, until a harsh and bracketed detainment at this pestiferous little airport followed by an unspecified hitch in the tombs, wherein New York's finest would perform upon my habeas corpus certain interrogation methods never prescribed by the Geneva Convention. I'm afraid of Americans, but I keep forgetting that I am an American too. It seems an unlikely thing to forget, but one way or another, I've been a nomad all my life. Under my real name, Hassan Sabah al-Ghazi, just call me Han, as people have since my 6th grade year, the year of those ubiquitous Star Wars movies. I became a naturalized citizen when I was 11. Dad moved us over here from Jerusalem after things got a little tense between himself and a false friend in the Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service. Our people have long sworn that Mossad eat what they kill. But my father, in disappearing, was actually doing the operative a favor, albeit one of a nature that would never hold up in court. But that's another tale for another day. I approach the gate. A petrified-looking Lebanese guy with a chicken chest and a fake badge puffs up in my face at the first metal detector. The Marines have a wonderful idiom for his sort, an empty uniform. His is hanging on him like a drop cloth. I stifle a laugh. "Sir," he barks in heavily accented English, "could you please remove your shoes?" I drop to one knee, hands where he can see them, and do so, handing them up. He inspects them, then looks as though he may presently swallow his chin. As he reaches for his radio, I stay his hand so quickly he doesn't anticipate the motion. Amateur. I address him softly in Arabic. "Look, Effendi, you push on the back and the heel fills up with air." I show him. He looks again and groans at my Reebok pump gym sneakers that are probably almost as old as he is. A thousand pardons, cousin. My boss, you understand. He asks that we... I sigh. Yeah, you're just doing your job. No worries. He scutters back to the X-ray conveyor, takes a long look at the screen, and hands me my bag. Shalom aleichem, Habibi. Safe journey. I bow with my right hand over my heart. Aseham aleichem shalom, cousin. Don't work too hard. Not possible, he chuckles and waves me through. I start looking for gate 11. The thought of hitting Boylston Street in Boston around dinner time makes me salivate. De gustibus est non disputandum, especially after the Swanson frozen fare in first class. From what I hear, the combat zone has been strip-mined of most of its red stoplights and dive bars, so further recreation is probably best left out. I wish I had time to hit the old MTA pneumatic railway tunnels down there and see if there are any new leads for me on the corkboard in the lobby of the other Pikmin gallery. But there's no time to schmooze with the denizens, let alone the citizens. I am to meet with my contact on Boston Common an hour after we land. Transportation has been arranged. We will drive much further north from there, along a particularly fierce section of the Massachusetts coastline. Most maps have forgotten our destination, simply listing it as an unincorporated township on a dead, played-out reef. But the old brain cases living on supplemental security in Arkham and Kingsport still call it Innsmouth. Innsmouth. I can taste the word in my throat like a raw calamari. My skin goes hot as my sweat goes cold. The word and the memory of the word fills my nostrils with the smell of cold boomtown gone bust. Mine dumps leaching sulfur into the water table. Sad, rotting houses covered over with Z-brick, with living denizens and permanently bolted doors. The word smells like Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease, leprosy, cannibalism, and 100 other kinds of runoff from inbreeding that science does not yet wish to name. I'm going back. The mere thought makes me better understand, in this moment, the hakaguri of the ancient Japanese samurai. It is the same with those of my faith who ply my trade. Behave as though the flesh is dead. Then, and now more than ever, one does not lose his mind when confronted with the dark. In place of fear, my thoughts turn to wrath, as Gate 11 looms large, just down the way a bit on the right. Several screaming children twine around me like cats for a moment. I consult my watch. I know I'm not late. Wrath. The denizens of Innsmouth deliberately flout my faith. The prophet teaches us that man evolved from clots of blood. Our learned men of this age teach also that somewhere between blood clot and Homo sapiens sapiens, we crawled out of the sea. This is not to be doubted. But Innsmouth follows an infidel faith, their own Shaitan, whom Islam has called Dagon since Babylon, has performed a miracle of fish unto any and every hard-luck sailor dumb or amateur enough to steer his tired old down-eastern Alexa into the waters off the town's own Devil Reef. Since the 1920s, decapod mating patterns in that part of the bay and migratory patterns of just about every aquatic species that ever turned a buck have climbed steadily with no spike in sight. Of course, the corporate fisheries were in there first, but the fish are so thick you could practically walk on the water like Yeshua. Dagon apparently shares and shares alike. By hypothetical evidence, which, being based in the supernatural, can neither be proven nor refuted in court, rock-ribbed Protestants in every hamlet for miles around Innsmouth are slowly being swayed to the notion that there might be other fish in the sea. To harvest said fish, their mad TV preacher boasts, you must devolve back to the blood clot, to drown beneath the waves of our own DNA, to crawl back to the womb and die. The prophet cast out Dagon with all the other false gods. My business with the debased tornado bait of Innsmouth is nothing more or less than jihad. One may work full-time during Ramadan for such a purpose, it is written. I just hope it's over with quickly. My contact is a rich writer from Bangor, only a few years my junior. Mr. Bachman is to outfit me with the necessary ordnance and artifacts. Dick also holds a private pilot's license. All the paperwork has been taken care of through my Oakland liaison. When did they start calling this section business elite, I wonder? Was first class too classist for these people? These funny, half-blind, blissfully oblivious, cell phone babbling off in their own little world Americans. It's their world, we're all just living in it. Long might some of them live to think so. I sigh, stepping hurriedly on board. The pilot looks like a whippet with an elaborate mop of gray hair, prescription shades, and a thick mustache. He grins a set of teeth like the white keys on a piano. "Welcome aboard! Happy holidays!" He briskly shakes my hand. I notice a bead of cocaine-colored snot twinkling just beneath his right nostril. Pilots are all alike. In Arabic, I tell him he's an idiot and he's going to get us all killed. He smiles and nods and herds me in. I slide up through coach, glancing at the seat number on my ticket. C4. Very funny, boss. You want me blown up that bad, do you? Freak. I can't help but chuckle. The intercom speakers blare into life. Good morning! Happy holidays! I part the curtain and venture into business elite, my eyes slightly ahead of me. Flight 180 will be departing LaGuardia in just a few minutes. Your... Oh, shit. I look down fast. A soccer mom 2 seats ahead glances back at me like I'm about to pull out a box cutter. Right now, she's the least of my worries. We Sufi have a kind of prayer for times like this. No matter what the Creator hands you, be it $100 or 2 broken legs, you smile as broadly as you can and say, "Thank you, sir, may I have another," and you laugh. Thus, the worse something gets, the more important it becomes to deflect it. But, my God, if the man, if such he can be termed, who I was hired to find in Innsmouth and kill, is seated right beside me on this plane? I committed the photograph to memory before I rolled a hashish spliff with it and smoked it to the head. This is a spot-on match. This is a practical joke. This is... Why, this is going to be a long flight. I smile, grit my teeth, and sit down, trying not to look at him. But to hear him slurp and slobber over that sushi box, sucking on his mucilaginous, webby fingers, a green rill of wasabi winding its way down his vestigial chin, my mind spools out its quiet dossier, calming my restless hands that want to make my shoelaces into garrots. Reverend Irving Waite, in the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. The false prophet I have been promised $10 million, half up front, and flown all the way from Oakland to smear from the skin of space and time. You can hear about something until the teller is blue in the face, but seeing it sit beside you is another matter entirely. He looks something like the jazz singer Mel Torme, if Mel were to commission a bust of himself as a horror movie latex appliance by Tom Savini. As the Marines say, he stinks like low tide took a shit in his pants. And then there's the reaction time thing. Lovely dinner company. I have been charged to end this creature. At present, I must somehow summon up the ingenuity to sit still for a 2+ hour flight and act as though I had no idea who he was. I shove my bag under the seat and give up. "How's the sushi?" I say. In my head, I'm humming an old family chant to harmonize body functions. My sense of smell cycles down to almost nothing. Waite's long, peeling head swivels like a newt's. His eyes are all wrong. I knew an autistic kid once in Jerusalem, a beggar's son, whose eyes were almost that shade of gold. But the cataracts in Waite's eyes, or whatever they really are, make the effect somehow more alarming. The tail of a shrimp hangs from his thick lower lip until he sees me looking and snaps it back. Most people would assume the black patches are squamous melanoma, flaking and coruscating at the sides of his wattled neck. Said neck, like his head, is home to alarmingly random patches of scraggly, nicotine-colored hair. Anyone would think the Reverend was taking chemotherapy. I know better. He's getting ready to go join the Eternal Family Reunion out on Devil Reef. He's getting ready to grow gills and use them. Heh, he's getting ready to clot. The Rev rumbles back in a voice like a shovel over wet cement. Tastes 2 days old. I could get better than this at home. His metabolism's probably so slowed down by now that he took this long to register my presence. That's an article of his faith, too, you see. With immortality comes ichthyic serenity, and thus their human shells are swallowed in Devonian slime. I smile and nod. I'll bet you could, I say. The conversation is left dangling. To the left of us, in C2, some punk kid is asleep with his shaven head against the window, blocking the view. He's dressed fairly nicely for his sort, in an all-black suit with no tie, a rack of hoop earrings, and a stud in either nostril. He looks exhausted. A crew-cut flight attendant, who looks and swishes alarmingly like Dr. Smith in the old Lost in Space show, pops up. "Would you care for a beverage after we get rolling?" "Green tea, no sugar." Very good, Mr. Sabah. He blinks at Wade. And we'll bring your clam juice for you too, Reverend. I'll check on him, he jerks a thumb at Punk Boy, later. Behind and above us, the tastefully concealed speakers drone on. Please discontinue the use of all cell phones during the taxi period. Flight attendants, cross-check and aisle call, please. Wade pushes his sushi box aside. Dr. Smith twinkles it away and flips the old bastard's tray table up for him, trying not to make a face at Wade's personal BO of fish and unknown precious metals. He does well, very professional.
Okay, the Reverend replies too late. Dr. Smith is long gone.
Reverend, I think, shuddering in the leather seat as we begin to taxi, and the pilot tells us over the loudspeakers that we will be first in line for takeoff. Reverend of what, a shithouse? I have a whole file cabinet on this fool. He's the titular head of the Esoteric Order of Dagon. No Union lobsterman or fisherman on that part of the coast will hear a word spoken against him. His kooky theosophical crossbreeding of Aleister Crowley and L. Ron Hubbard has cranked his books to the top of the New York Times bestseller list for weeks on end. Until very recently, his arena revivals packed in the faithful deeper than the wildest dreams of Billy Graham. But Wade isn't on the revival circuit anymore. He looks like hell in a bunt pan. I wonder about his game plan. My employer in Oakland, Mr. Thotep, if you please, is exactly right. Now's the perfect time to strike, before Wade passes on the racket that he's apparently running by remote control these days. Two rows behind us, a baby is crying very loudly. Something tells me again that I'm in for a long flight. I could sit still for days if that's what it takes. I have, in the cold plains of Kyrgyzstan and Outer Mongolia and the nearly nameless nightmare countries close to the top of the world, teasing my kills, waiting out every Carinthia. But give me a chance when we land, and Wade will be going to that great big fish hatchery in the sky. I look out the window at the obscenely gibbous moon over the desolate hubbub of Ground Zero, where the World Trade Center towers were, as we ascend above the pollution and the clouds. As always, when I see that dry socket in the earth, I do my level best to cry, though the actual act is, in my case, impossible, and beg Allah's forgiveness upon us all. I haven't been able to cry since my last op in Afghanistan. My tears are on the inside. From somewhere, in-flight Muzak blithely murders the entire Dave Matthews Band. I unfold the little screen from my armrest, find my remote, turn it sideways, punch a few buttons, and wait for in-flight Tetris to download, trying not to think about the thing in the seat beside me. In the name of all that is holy, why isn't Wade on a private jet? He could afford a fleet of Lears with the donations from his crusades, and oh, how apropos the latter word is. I could snap his neck right now. But Innsmouth folk are quite hard to kill by ordinary means. It would take several tries and attract too much notice. Do I speak from experience? I wish I didn't. What are the chances that he'd be flying on Christmas, anyway? I'd thought to get a leg up, slip into Innsmouth on Greyhound under cover of night and get this over with. I could be in the Caymans the next morning smoking ganja on the beach. But Allah has more in store for me than the easy road. At the front of the cabin, the screen now glows with a brown and green map of our journey. The speakers whinge on once more.
This is your captain speaking. We have leveled off at 37,000 feet. Winds are at 10 miles an hour. Visibility is moderate to low, with overcast skies and low cloud cover. We will be arriving in Boston in approximately 2 hours' time. Please enjoy your flight. Happy holidays.
Dr. Smith bobs up from the forward flight attendants area, pushing a cart. I set Tetris on level 10, wait again, and bow over the steaming blue earthen mug of tea he hands me. Thankfully, I can't smell the clam juice he sets before wait, professionally folding the Reverend's tray table down once more and placing the cup there in one quick move. Bleh. The kid in C2 is awake now. His voice is a throaty rasp.
Excuse me, boss. Next time you come by, could I get a cup of coffee?
Dr. Smith nods immediately.
We've got French roast, cappuccino, and...
The kid grins an endearing, crooked grin. Black in a cup. Dr. Smith nods briskly and retreats to the next row. The kid shakes his head.
Well, you can't beat this. They just shoved me in first class. Gotta love Priceline.
Ah. I sip my tea, flip the screen down into my armrest, and turn it off with the remote. Conversation is always preferable on a long flight.
The luck of the draw, I say. Why are you flying on Christmas?
The kid shrugs.
Why not?
That's fair, but I'm bored and cautious.
Were you in the military?
His hair has the look of being perpetually cut short by choice. I surmise that we could swap soldier stories the entire flight.
Nah, they wouldn't take me.
He slapped his knee. Game leg and 4F. You?
A bit. Not in America, though.
Wait is looking at the kid as if he wonders how he might taste. The kid ignores him completely.
Where did you do your service?
All over the Middle East. I was a consultant, you might say. I'm done with that now, though. He nods.
My sister's put it like that, too. I'm done. I guess I can understand that. Maybe I'm better off.
What do you do now? I ask. Beside him, Wade appears to nod off like a chicken with its head placed beneath its wing.
I write comic books, creator-owned projects are going the way of the dinosaur, but there are all sorts of ways around that.
He names a few he writes for. You'd know them. You'd know his name, too, if you're seriously into that sort of thing. I nod.
Do you know Grant Morrison?
That's just the first name I think of. I used to read Doom Patrol sometimes when I could keep up with... Dr. Smith passes back by with the kid's coffee. Here you are, sweetie.
Thanks. Yeah, I met him once. The kid beams. What a neat guy. I remember staying up with him to 4 in the morning at the Hyatt in San Francisco talking about whether or not Rod Serling was right and the past really is inviolable.
Ah. My compulsive reading pays off sometimes.
Serling got that from Jack Finney. Did you know of him?
The kid frowns.
Didn't he write Time and Again?
Yes, also a book of short stories called... I stop. The back of my neck is alive with a chill. The kid looks unfazed.
Yeah, he answers the question I didn't ask. I felt it too.
Hmm. A visor drops over his face. I know that visor very well, from those strange, strange days in Afghanistan in the 80s before the shit hit the fan and we were airlifted out. I saw it every time I looked in the mirror to shave back then. On the few cold mornings in Kandahar when anything but a dry shave was available. I wonder what hell this kid has been through to heighten his senses like that.
I thought it was just me, he begins.
Then out of nowhere, Reverend Waite stands up and steps into the aisle. The next few minutes are the only time in my life I've ever been sorry to have been born an Arab. Things are falling into place, changing, switching perspectives like angles in a haunted house. I will myself to concentrate on what's really here. There's a choked gurgling sound over the loudspeakers. The plane banks hard right and down. In the row in front of us, a blue-haired old lady with a portable oxygen tank and a tube in her nose screams at the top of her lungs, clutching her chest. Waite cocks his head at her, his cataracted eyes burning bright. She goes limp in her seat, hands flopping in opposite directions, the life leaving her like the filament breaking in a light bulb that quick. The kid shrinks back in his seat, frantically searching his pockets while trying to keep the rest of him still.
Hey, what did you...
Then I see her jerk forward and hear her sudden silence. The seat to the old lady's right is empty. The passengers across the aisle are panicking and simply don't see. From coach and business elite alike, more screams and heard terror babble ramp up as the plane begins to vibrate. Wild lightning rattles through the seas of clouds outside. Turbulence shakes everything with Loma Prieta scale force. Tray tables bounce, drinks spill hither and yon. My tea flies toward the front of the cabin like a rocket-propelled grenade. I turn around. In the front row of the coach section, where the curtain has been yanked aside, a young girl with her hair dyed 3 different Crayola colors, claws at her seatbelt, eyes bugging out. Beside her, her boyfriend is still asleep. A grossly fat yuppie with a Jimmy Carter part in his hair bulls to his feet, brandishing his briefcase, and charges me, bellowing, "Allah this, motherfucker!" His tie's crooked. His loafers pound the aisle as his seatbelt clatters to the ground. The only friend of Allah on this plane is sitting perfectly still, yawning. The yuppie observes this phenomenon and sees Waite standing in the aisle, alive and alight, not a bit groggy at all. Waite grins with small, sharp teeth. One webbed hand comes up, palm down, fat sushi gummy fingers splayed. He croaks something that might once have been a word. The yuppie falls backward into seat D5, knocking over an old man's martini glass. The old man screams, almost scooting into the lap of a snotty-looking little princess who pushes him away.
No! Ew! Help!
The yuppie rolls onto the floor, not looking like he wants up, or like he's breathing. Waite folds his arms. The look on his jowly face says, "Next?" But the imperious son of a bitch isn't even going to say anything. My faith teaches
that in times of common disaster, every believer is the executor of Allah's law. I'm just waiting for these fools to quit flogging and play their hand. Once more, the cockpit speakers crackle. For a time, nothing comes out of them. They're testing the mics. My dad taught me that, in debased Atlantean, the phrase was their answer to our Alif Lamim. This book is not to be doubted. But they're quoting the Necronomicon, not the Quran. The Necronomicon is not to be doubted for all the wrong reasons. Even hearing it makes me want to pick up a sword and start cutting heads. Beside me, the kid's playing possum. Smart. Wait grins, taking a deep breath through the gill slits in his scabby throat. "Today shalt thou be with us in paradise," he croaks. No one on the whole plane has a problem hearing that. The speakers are still on, ringing with dead silence over the whine of the engines and the rattle of the wings. Every passenger is in panic mode, too confused to really listen.
"Citizens of America, please do not attempt to thwart the beloved who are now flying this Boeing 767 aircraft."
The voice from the speakers is burbling, staticky, full of the wrong inflections.
"There will be one refueling stop over the Bermuda Triangle. Please do remain still and no one will be harmed until cabin is depressurized."
A knot of people, all ages and sexes, attempt to storm the cockpit, taking turns pounding on the door. A similar knot makes for the back, every commuter wanting to be the first one to hide in the lavatory. The flight attendants, Dr. Smith included, attempt to direct traffic and mostly get plowed under. The baby is wailing grand opera. The devil commands.
"Your government sank the nuclear sub USS Burnside off Devil Reef in Massachusetts and then lied about it in the news. Our people are dying down there. You elected the ones who do this thing to us. Sacrifice must be made to Dagon and Great Cthulhu Elimoku to repay for then. Relay surfaces this night off the forbidden atoll. Draw near and know."
Even when I was 17, I spoke better English than these guys. I shake my head and move toward the kid, and he pushes me deliberately away with great force. The move is made to look random. He really is playing possum. I take my cue. The world narrows down for me. There is no one else on that plane but myself and my adversary. A cheap Skillcraft pin has fallen onto the seat from the kid's pocket. I reach for it, not understanding what I see out the window. It's like the northern lights are going on outside just for us. A fantastic rainbow stereopticon flicker play, a spectral fantasy above the clouds. Mists of unknown hue swirl around the plane, faster and faster. All I can think over and over was, "Kill the head and the body will die." I take two steps diagonally behind Wade, yank his head back, and shove the pin up his nose with a brutal Hapkido palm strike. The sound the pin makes when it hits cartilage is like a boning knife meeting a rack of lamb. Just for chuckles, I tear out both the Reverend's gills with my bare hands, cutting my palms up quite badly in the process. I feel his essence surging and lapping around me, seeking to gain a foothold as its body dies. I'm humming a different chant now, focusing my energy into my pelvic floor and pushing the intruder out through my feet. "No one in my body but me," I snarl. My teeth chop down on each other hard. Weight slumps to the floor, leaking black ichor all over my gym shoes. But it's not quite game over. There's one more infidel on this plane. I smell it. I just hope it doesn't smell me. Shoving my way through the throng, I reach the cockpit door. It was never completely locked. Fools. I kick it in. A trembling, scaly thing mans the controls. It looks like it belongs in a carnival jar of formaldehyde. Three extremely leaky bodies in white shirts and gold epaulets clutter the floor. The creature looks hungrily out the window, snuffling up the last of the pilot's cocaine, rolling it around on toothless gums with one webbed finger. It sees me and gets to its feet. I move on it then. Ponk. The coffee pot connects with its head, and the critter goes down. "God go with us, friend," the punk kid says from beside me in a good accent. The thing starts to get up. The kid kicks it boredly in the head with one Doc Martin boot. It makes a hrumping noise and goes down again. "Put your jaw back in place and blink," he instructs me.
For the first time, I really notice how careworn his face is, distantly pondering the terrors it must have witnessed as he speaks again. I grew up in Arkham. I saw shit like this going on in my high school, man. These guys must have thought they were dealing with a bunch of amateurs. Now you... He waits. I figured you were in some kind of black ops since you didn't have a million war stories for me. His eyes plead. Can you fly? I'm already frowning at the altimeter and sitting down. Leave that to me. Dr. Smith pops up behind us, looking relieved, holding a first aid kit. My bloody hands grip the tiller. All the other flight attendants break into a ragged cheer. Then the passengers begin to cheer, too. I wonder how loudly they'd cheer if they knew my family trade. We've been assassins since the Crusades. We Sabah follow the Sufi path. What that means to those with our calling is simply a hunger for clipping spooks, especially big money spooks, like the one who just got done bleeding cod liver oil all over my sneakers. Then again, for $10 million, I could buy a lot more gym shoes. C'est la guerre. Without asking, the kid sits down near the cooling clay of the co-pilot and grabs the radio. Mayday, 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 he rasps. This is Flight 180. I have no idea where we are, but we got a good pilot. Tell me what's up. My money will be in the bank by the time I land this bird, take 3 showers, and hunt for a bottle of emotional bleach. After that, as I promised myself, I'm done. At the thought, my tear ducts decide to start working again. So do not become weak or sad, and you shall triumph if you are indeed believers. Koran 3:139.
Whether we like it, or them, or not, each decade brings a set of stereotypes with it, a fictional toy box that authors will spend the full 10 years playing with. The first decade of the 21st century, for all the wrong reasons unfortunately, numbers anti-terrorist experts, suicide bombers, and sky marshals amongst those fictional tropes. What's interesting though, 8 years in, especially with this story, is the way in which these tropes are evolving, even being subverted. The most obvious example is Jack Bauer, who 7 years ago could make Chuck Norris cry, a one-man army who did any and everything to protect his family and do his job. Now, Jack is a man all too aware of the fact that he's little more than a weapon and desperately trying to reconnect with his humanity, although, if I were a betting man, I would suspect that that reconnection will come at the price of an awful lot of terrorists' fingers, spleens, and I suspect unmentionable bits. Likewise, films like The Kingdom and novels like Charles Stross's Laundry series take these established character types and not only alter them and place them in context, but, certainly in the case of Stross's books, put them together with older character types to tremendous effect. As there, so here. Edward combines very modern concerns with a very old concept, and the message, it seems, is simple. Meet the new fears, same as the impossibly old ones. The good news is that sometimes, even now, just sometimes, we all get to win. Pseudopod is staffed by Ben Phillips, editor-in-chief and billionaire playboy, Alistair Stewart, host, Bon Vivant and Jazz Maverick, and Ellen Allen, slush wrangler and two-fisted doom knitter. And Pseudopod relies on you to pay its authors. Seriously, we do. Every cent you send in goes to keep authors in pens, paper, electricity, noodles, whatever they need to do their job. So, if you liked this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. I promise you won't regret it. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. And Pseudopod needs to get this straight. This is a maximum security prison, and you have no weapons of any kind?